My Home and Native Land, written by Copper Badge and or Sam Starbuck. Written for the LiveJournal community, I Defeated SGA. Rating PG, part 1 of 4. Pairing Jen. Summary. Ronan's friendship with Chuck, the head gate tech of the Atlantis mission, leads him to discover the strange and alien ways of Canadians, and helps him lay his past to rest. In days of yore from Britain's shore, Wolf, the dauntless hero, came, and planted firm Britannia's flag on Canada's fair domain. Ronan Dex was a specialist in the Sititan Army, an officer and an educated man in a reasonably advanced society. He was trained in military protocol, much similar to the code of conduct held by the Marines and Air Force officers on Atlantis. He had been off-world a handful of times as part of maneuvers before his army fell, and he had been trained in gate recon, though he'd never officially been assigned. He was also one of those rare souls in whom the military had not quashed the urge to ask forgiveness rather than permission. So when he returned from his first off-world mission with the Atlanteans, he naturally took the notebook out of his pocket, tore off the small sheet of paper, scrawled his name and the date on the top, and handed it to the gate tech, the young one who wore the same tribal insignia as McKay, but didn't talk half so much. Growing up with McKay would probably do that to anyone. "What's this?" the gate tech asked, studying it. "Gate sheet," Ronan answered. "Yeah, but what is it?" the tech asked again. "I mean, I can see the symbols, but what's the rest?" Ronan belatedly realized it was in Sititan. It's a log of all the known worlds Alessia does trade with." The tech's eyebrows shot up. "Where'd you get it?" Ronan stared at him. "I asked." They regarded each other for a few seconds before Ronan realized this is what he'd started to think of as an absentee protocol. Things the Marines should be doing and weren't. Like the ritual tattooing and basic knife training. "When you go through a gate, you ask them what addresses they know," he explained, feeling kindly towards the ignorant tech. "You note them down and give them to the tech so they can track them." "Oh yeah, we've never done that," the tech said, but not dismissively, more like he was considering something.
"You should," Ronan said, "because, well, duh."
"It's a good idea. Why'd you write it in, oh, guess you can't write English, eh?" Ronan crossed his arms. "Not that you need to, except probably they're going to want mission reports from you, but..." The tech trailed off thoughtfully. "Can I keep this for a few days?"
"You're supposed to keep it," Ronan pointed out, "and put your name on the sheet and the time you received it."
The tech nodded and took the pen Ronan offered.
"Man, Atlanteans are never fucking prepared."
And scrawled Charles Morse in the corner, then noted the time. He carefully handed the pen back and set the piece of paper next to the DHD, smoothing it out. Turned out, they did want a mission report from him, which he'd be happy to give, written or oral, except, you know, they didn't want oral, and he didn't write in English. Still, he was resourceful, and if he couldn't write it, then he'd have to find someone to write it for him. The fastest typist he knew was McKay, and McKay was pretty easily intimidated by a couple of grunts and the knowledge of just how many knives Ronan had concealed about his person. 17 on standby, 24 for missions, 9 on his day off. He tracked McKay down and loomed efficiently until McKay started bitching about what a waste of time it was to make a scientist act like a secretary. McKay shut up when Ronan started talking, though, and his fingers began to click the keys automatically, his face growing less and less annoyed and more thoughtful as Ronan succinctly outlined the events on planet, the resources expended and the injuries sustained, and any relevant information the Eleusians had let slip. "You really were a soldier?" McKay asked when it was done and set to Shepard for vetting before Dr. Weir got it.
"Really am," Ronan replied, and went on his way with the satisfaction of a job well done.
He didn't see the gate tech again until they were kitting up for the next mission, supposedly escorting Taylor somewhere boring and diplomatic. He probably thought she didn't need much of an escort, but it was a chance to get off-world, and McKay and Shepard were pretty funny when they were bored. While Taylor did the negotiating and Shepard struck his "I could menace you at any minute" pose, and McKay wandered around with his energy detector out, Ronan ambled down to the Central Archive, then to the Tavern, then to the Market Square, and came back with 3 pages of gate addresses. This time Charles Morse was prepared. He had a pen, took the pages without question, signed his name and the time.
"That reminds me," he said, tucking the pages in an official-looking folder. "I'm off duty in 2 hours. Can you come translate these for me? Just read them aloud and..."
"Yeah, I know," Ronan said.
Oh, of course you would," Charles Morse replied, grinning. "Anyway, I'll be in the mess. Stop by? Have some not-quite pork chops. Translate for me."
"Sure," Ronan shrugged.
"Cool."
"Ronan," Dr. Beckett called from the gate room floor.
"If you're done flirting, I would like to do the post-mission examination sometime this afternoon."
A couple of the other techs giggled, and Charles Morse grinned, even as the tips of his ears turned red.
Earthers were really immature. He found Charles Morris sitting at one of the long tables at the start of dinner, when there weren't many people around yet. He tossed his tray down and slid into the seat, grunting a greeting as the tech looked up. He held out his notebook. "So that's your name," he said, pointing to a reasonable approximation of the English Charles Morris. English had a truly hideous and annoying set of ideograms. "How do you say it?"
"Charles Morris," the tech replied, "but everyone calls me Chuck."
"'Kay, give me the pages." Chuck opened the folder and passed the gate sheets back to him, including the old one. He picked up a tablet from the chair next to him and offered that as well.
"I've put in all the dialing codes," he said, pointing to a display on the tablet. "What I was thinking is, once I know what all this is, I'll put together something to show Dr. Weir. She's already said I can make a presentation at the next staff meeting."
"Cool," Ronan answered, and started to read. PXR 786. He trailed off after only a few seconds about how the inhabitants of PXR 786, who called themselves the Kalari, were expert weavers. Chuck was looking at his face, but one of his hands was dancing over the tablet surface, keying in the information with even more speed than Dr. McKay.
"You type one-handed," he observed, and Chuck unaccountably laughed.
"Well, it's faster when you've got to dial with your other. It's a one-handed keyboard, see? If I hit the Alt key, it swaps over. Took some training, but I broke my wrist at university and had to learn then anyway."
"Fight?" Ronan asked.
No. Chuck looked embarrassed. "I was, showing off in a tree."
Ronan raised an eyebrow.
"And kind of fell out of it. Anyway, keep going."
Ronan read out the rest of the notes he'd made, which didn't take long. Most of the addresses didn't have much more than a few sentences attached. When he was done, Chuck tapped on the screen to save it and clear it, and attacked his dessert with something much resembling McKay's enthusiasm. Well, that figured. "So," Ronan said, as Chuck spooned the crumbly fruit pie into his mouth, "is your whole tribe pacifist or what?"
"Tribe?" Chuck asked, around a mouthful of syrup and fruit.
Ronan nodded at the insignia on his shoulder.
"Oh, it's a country, not a tribe. Canada. We're not pacifists. We just didn't send any soldiers."
"McKay's Canadian."
"Canadian, yeah. Try not to judge us based on Rodney McKay," Chuck added with a grimace. "This," he tapped the flag with a finger, "it's our national symbol. It's a leaf."
"Yeah, I got that," Ronan said dryly.
Did your country..."
"Setida."
"Setida? Did it have a flag?"
"The tribes had pennants," Ronan said absently, "and tattoos."
"Tattoos, is that?"
Chuck gestured to the place on his throat that matched Ronan's. "Is my regiment," Ronan said.
"And your arms?" Chuck indicated the row of neat triangles.
"Kills." Chuck looked suitably impressed.
"Wraith?"
"Sometimes. Haven't kept it up. I should add what's missing."
"Cool. Most of the Marines who have tattoos have dumb ones, like those fake curly things or Semper Fi in really ugly lettering."
"Semper Fi?"
"It's their motto. Semper Fidelis. Always faithful."
"To what?"
"Don't know," Chuck chewed thoughtfully. "America, I guess. That's their country. And Colonel Shepard's, too. But, like, you have a tattoo for your tribe?"
"Uh-huh."
"Where?" Chuck asked, lowering his voice.
"My ass," Ronan said, just to see what kind of reaction it got. Chuck choked on his food, looked at him, and then scowled.
"You so do not have your sacred tribal tattoo on your ass, Dex," he said.
Ronan tugged at the collar of his shirt down and pointed it out just below his clavicle. Chuck studied it with clinical interest, then nodded satisfied.
"We don't really have tribes, I guess," he said.
"How do you know where you came from?"
Chuck paused. "That's a good question," he said.
Ronan had not been at all surprised when he was asked to join the senior staff in their weekly meetings. After all, he represented a military point of view, which meant Shepard would be happy to have him as backup, and he was a member of the lead exploration team. It was his right. He tried not to be bored, because it was an honor as well as a right. But man, these people could talk. He knew McKay felt the same way, despite McKay himself being head talker of Talk City talking to him, but at least McKay talked fast. The next meeting promised to be at least interesting, when he arrived and saw Chuck sitting on the edge of one of the seats, fiddling nervously with the tablet in front of him. He could relate. It was tough to be the low-ranking officer, and Satidan regiments hadn't encouraged original thought or underlings making suggestions any more than any other military institution did.
"All right," Dr. Weir said as everyone settled down for the meeting. "Everybody here, everybody awake. Let's try to make this quick. Chuck, you have a presentation for us?"
Chuck flinched a little, poor kid, and stood up.
"Yeah, I..."
He clicked a button and a tablet on the screen behind him lit up.
"Gate addresses?" McKay asked. "Where'd you find those?"
McKay, Dr. Weir said warningly.
I didn't find them, actually, Chuck said. I've been building a database of unvisited planets based on some recon Colonel Shepard's team brought back.
When did we do recon? Shepard asked.
Specialist X has been retrieving gate addresses from local populations, Chuck said smoothly, as if this part he'd prepared ahead of time.
It was cool to hear that again. Specialist Dex. Ronan? Shepard asked.
Yeah, Ronan said.
Apparently in the Satidan military, it was standard procedure to record gate addresses from other worlds, with notes on traitors and who was at war with whom, that kind of thing, Chuck continued. Specialist Dex brought back several addresses and passed them off to me for signature.
Well, that's less than stupid, McKay said, sounding surprised.
I thought it was a pretty good idea, so I'd like to propose...
Chuck looked anxiously at Dr. Weir.
I'd like to propose that we make it a standard practice for all exploration teams. It doesn't have to be a requirement, just, if someone has some spare time, they contact the locals and get some notes. I'll be in charge of building the database, and my deck team can prepare the paperwork. As you can see, he began flicking through the database entries, Specialist Dex and I have already built the prototype filing system. I think it could be an enormous asset to the mission. We'll cross-reference with the main planetary database, of course.
What about misinformation? Outdated information? Shepard asked.
That's a risk, of course, but it's not as though we're acting on the information. It's just supplementary, in case we need it. And it'll give us an organized way to begin investigating other planets when the teams have some downtime. Each off-world team will need to appoint someone to recon, preferably someone who writes in English. Most of my people have a second language, but we all have English.
You and Ronan cooked this up, Shepard said, glancing at Ronan, who tried to look modest.
Mostly Specialist Dex, Chuck answered. I just did the programming.
Seems pretty smart to me, Dr. Weir said. Colonel?
I got no problems. Ronan, you want to be our recon go-to guy?
Sure, Ronan said. I can train some other people, too.
Settled, then. Chuck, draw up some guidelines and protocols. Work with Ronan.
Chuck's smile broke over his face, equal parts triumphant and relieved. And that was another thing about Earthers. They couldn't keep a poker face to save their lives. Except Shepard. But he was practically a Satidan soul anyway.
Thank you, Dr. Weir. Colonels, doctors, Specialist X, he said,
nodding to everyone in turn, and bolted from the room. After the meeting, Ronan wandered up to the gate room, where Chuck was supervising repairs on a malp that had encountered a little unfriendly attention off-world.
So I gotta file a mission report. Tail is all over my ass about it, he opened, which made Chuck grin.
The rest of the techs working on the map looked like they would rather be anywhere else, which was not an unfamiliar look to Ronan. Can't type in English.
Want me to type it for you? Chuck said.
One of his techs looked at him like he was insane.
I could pay you. Dr. Weir says I get paid now, Ronan shrugged.
Step into my parlor, Chuck said, leading him away from the map repairs and up to the console deck.
You don't have to pay me. I mean, it probably won't take long, right? And you'd better clear it with Colonel Shepard. I'm not sure I have security clearance for some of the stuff you could tell me.
Sure, Ronan said. That mean you'll do it?
Yeah, sounds interesting. I'll teach you how to, if you want.
Tell you what, Chuck snapped his fingers and pointed at him, and seriously, Canada might as well be a tribe. Chuck was totally related to McKay somehow. Ronan knew it.
I'll teach you to write in English. You teach me how to do that awesome thing with your blaster.
Shoot people? Ronan asked.
No, the twirly thing, you know, when you show off in the gate room to mess with Shepard.
Ronan grinned. You can't touch my gun, Chuck.
I'll make a mock-up like they do for the cadet corps back home.
You don't let your cadets handle real guns? How do you weed out the ones who can't duck fast enough?
Chuck narrowed his eyes.
You're fucking with me, aren't you?
Just a little.
This is lame, Ronan said 4 days later. English is really ugly.
Well, you can learn English, or you can just give me the blaster lessons for the rest of the time in return for typing up your reports.
Someday I'm going to get good enough you'll have to let me try the real thing, Chuck said, crossing his arms.
Yeah, Ronan agreed. That's gonna happen.
So come on. English has 26 letters.
Satidan has 40.
It's not the size of the alphabet, it's how you use it, Chuck said,
which was probably some other Earther joke Ronan was missing out on. He made a mental note to ask Shepard about it, because Shepard got totally messed up when he asked about Earth humor.
Do you know any of these?
Ronan eyed the two neat rows of letters.
They're out of order.
Chuck turned to the letters.
That's not how they're set up on your keyboard, Ronan explained. This one goes first, he said, pointing to the circle with a line through it, which bore the faintest of resemblances to the Satidan third vowel.
Let's table the whole touch typing concept for a minute. I'll explain that one later, Chuck said. They're in the right order the way we learned them as kids.
This is going to be really bad, isn't it? Ronan asked. Chuck sighed.
Probably, he said. But I'm Canadian. I'll get through it.
So, there's no actual angle anymore? Ronan asked, standing in the empty firing range and watching Chuck assemble a mocked-up wooden blaster model. He'd give Earth this. Their people knew how to build stuff.
As in the place English derives from? Well, we have England, Chuck said. Canada used to be part of Great Britain, like England was.
It was an empire. So you were conquered?
We settled there, though, yeah, sort of, Chuck said. It's complicated. Come on, show me some twirling.
Ronan rolled his eyes and took out his blaster, showing Chuck how to hold it. The Canadian mimicked his movements clumsily. I still say it's pretty ugly, he said.
And Chuck snapped his finger in the fake blaster's hinge. English is one of the most beautiful languages in the world, he said around his finger, sucking the pinch part.
Yeah, but that's just one world.
English is awesome, and you can't convince me otherwise, Chuck insisted, trying the simple half-flip again.
Ow! Damn!
Ronan rolled his eyes and held out his hand, showing the loose grip. Oh, gotcha. Anyway, English is great, Chuck insisted, managing not to maim himself with the blaster this time.
Prove it.
Proof's the Tetons any better.
Ronan triple-flipped the barrel. Chuck rolled his eyes.
Okay, whatever, Chuck said. Your world is pretty military, right? You must have some, like, epics and things.
We had our share.
Well, English has its share, too. Okay, listen to this, Chuck said, focusing on the blaster as he talked.
Ronan double-flipped, and Chuck tried and dropped it before bouncing up again, tossing the model in his hand to get a better feel for it.
Ronan was totally unprepared for the words coming out of Chuck's mouth, words that he'd heard in Satetan, but with a strange roll and cadence that was pure English. It little profits that an idle king, by this still hearth among these barren crags, matched with an aged wife, I mete and dole unequal laws unto a savage race, that hoard and sleep and feed, and know not me. I cannot rest from travel. I will drink life to the lees. All times I have enjoyed greatly, have suffered greatly, both with those that loved me and alone, Chuck recited, then swore when he caught himself in the hinge again.
Whoa, Ronan said. It seemed to fulfill the requirements. Chuck looked up, laughed.
That's Tennyson, famous poet. Had to memorize it for grade 10 English. He took a deep breath and watched as Ronan demonstrated the half-flip twist, talking through it.
Ronan listened, hands moving idly.
And drunk delight of battle with my peers, far on the ringing plains of windy Troy. I am a part of all that I have met, yet all experience is an arch wherethrough gleams the untraveled world, whose margins fades forever and forever, when I move. How dull it is to pause.
Damn it! Here, Ronan said, and took Chuck's hand off the model, showing him how to bend his fingers in the trigger guard for a proper spin as Chuck kept talking.
Death closes all. Thanks, I got it. But something ere the end, some work of noble note may be yet be done, not unbecoming men that strove with gods.
It was probably best to keep him talking. You didn't have to think about fighting or movement. You just taught your muscles to go. Even as he realized his own shoulders were clenched as the words poured out of the Canadian's mouth.
Though much is taken, much abides, and though we are not now that strength which in old days moved earth and heaven, that which we are, we are. One equal temper of heroic hearts made weak by time and fate, but strong in will to strive, to seek, to find, and not to yield.
Chuck grinned at him, executed a perfect single flip with a spin, and bowed. Is all your poetry like that? Ronan asked.
We are not now that strength which in old days moved earth and heaven.
Yeah, he could relate.
The good stuff, Chuck said. Oh, you mean about wars and kings? Lots of it is.
Okay, Ronan said. You can still teach me English.
Ronan ate with his team most of the time, and he spent enough time learning the stupid alphabet with Chuck that he didn't really think the guy wanted him hanging around at meals, too.
McKay, he soon discovered, had absolutely no use for poetry of any kind, and Shepard was pretty illiterate on the subject. Dr. Weir sometimes ate with them, but it wasn't polite to pepper the mission ahead with questions or unnecessary speech, and besides, she creeped him out, so he didn't ask her. Sometimes Dr. Peckett would sit with them, usually if McKay invited him, and he was pretty cool about it.
I don't know if you hear it when I talk, Beckett said, but I don't speak the same as John and Rodney.
Yeah, it sounds different, Ronan said.
Well, that's because I'm Scots, see, and from a different part of the world.
I just figured it wasn't your first language, like Dr. Zelenka.
No, it's a dialect, and, Beckett continued, this is how English is supposed to sound.
Oh, that is, McKay began, but Beckett held up a hand. He was one of, like, three people who could shut McKay up.
This is the accent that Shakespeare wrote for.
It is so not, McKay protested.
Close enough. Now listen to this, Beckett said, and rolled the words out with relish.
Once more into the breach, dear friends, once more. Or close the wall up with our English dead. In peace, there's nothing so becomes a man as modest stillness and humility.
With a sidelong look at McKay.
But when the blast of war blows in our ears, then imitate the action of the tiger. Stiffen the sinews, summon up the blood, disguise fair nature with hard-favored rage. Then lend the eye a terrible aspect. And there's a bit with a cannon, I think, comes next. Right. The next I know is, for there is none of you so mean and base that hath not noble lustre in your eyes. I see you stand like greyhounds in the slip, straining upon the start. The game's afoot. Follow your spirit, and upon the charge cry, God for Harry, England, and St. George!
Applause broke out from the nearby table. Beckett nodded graciously to them. Ronan looked to his left. Shepherd was sitting, fork poised in one hand, his breathing a little quicker than normal. Well, naturally. Shepherd was a soldier, too. Still, come on, it was only words. He had heard better from Chuck. Do you guys only have poems about war? Ronan asked. Everybody blinked at him.
No, there's love poems and such, Beckett said cautiously. Shakespeare wrote a fair deal of those, too.
He sounds pretty cool.
Pretty cool, Beckett echoed faintly. Yes, well, I suppose so.
Ronan lingered after the others had gone. McKay to do something sciencey with science, Shepherd trailing after him as always, Taylor to beat up Marines with sticks, and Beckett to do whatever it was Scott's people did in their time off. He saw Chuck at a nearby table with a couple of Marines and two other gate techs when he nodded a greeting. The others in the group hunched over and spoke in low voices, like he couldn't hear them or something. Nothing really that extraordinary. He was used to being talked about by now, and while a foot soldier like the Marines were could pick a fight, Ronan was a specialist and above petty private insults.
Seriously, I think he's going to bite me.
Nah. Shepard's got him trained.
You guys are assholes. That was Chuck. Ronan's good people.
He's like 9 feet tall, one of the Marines said.
Is he? Chuck asked. I hadn't noticed.
Seriously, should he be allowed to just wander around? I hear he keeps knives in his hair, one of the techs said.
Well, he's got the hair for it, Chuck observed. Who cares? He's not going to knife you in the bathroom, Mendelssohn. He's cool.
Cool?
Yeah, he's not a moron, and he can probably hear you, by the way, Chuck said. The rest of the group looked up at him with the almost comical unity. He gave them a small wave and a feral grin.
Oh, man, oh, man. The one who'd made the remark about Shepherd had him trained groaned.
Relax. If the big bad Satidan scares you, you can hide behind me. I told you, he's cool. There's nothing to be afraid of, Chuck continued. He's not like a barbarian or anything. He had the same boot camp you did, probably.
So are you dating or what? One of the techs asked,
with a much nastier tone than a polite inquiry required. Chuck rolled his eyes.
Yeah, Annie. I can't have any other motivation for hanging out with him other than to get into his pants. It's not like he has something interesting things to say or useful contributions to... Oh, wait, that's right. That database you think is the best thing since ENIAC? Didn't he come up with that?
Ronan grinned into his dessert. Besides, he's on Shepard's off-world team. Look at that team. You think the military leader of Atlantis picked McKay for his people skills and Taylor for her tits, and Ronan for being 9 feet tall?
He definitely didn't pick Taylor for her tits, one of the Marines said.
Ronan looked sidelong in time to catch a rude gesture. Apparently, he wasn't the only one who noticed the colonel didn't pay much attention to tits.
McKay's good with the machines, one of the techs suggested.
McKay's a badass, and the only reason you don't know it is you're never on duty when they come in hot. The team has Shepard and Taylor besides. They don't need more brawn. Ronan's smart. He knows where to look and when. Shepard's got layers. He wants guys with layers on his team.
Are you sure you don't want to get into Shepard's pants?
My home and native land, part 2. Here may it wave, our boast, our pride, and joined in love together, the thistle shamrock rose entwined, the maple leaf forever. Nobody really understood how Gate Translation worked, though he had heard McKay give an annoyed speech about universal translators and how the Gate didn't even seem to use science. At least Star Trek put in the effort, like 10,000 times. It was just that if you passed through the Gate, when you came out the other side, you were speaking their language, or yours, but it sounded to them like theirs. It accounted for dialect and accent, which amused Ronan. The Lankan's English sounded to him like High Satidan, the language used in law courts and at the capital, the accent of a highly cultured man. Beckett sounded like a working-class drawl from the south of the city. And while McKay and Shepherd and Chuck all sounded vaguely alike, Shepherd's had a note of childish slang to it, as if he'd grown up without much parental supervision. It only showed up when he was really annoyed, though, or trying to bait McKay. Ronan found out, as the lessons went on, that while you couldn't read another language, you could convert it if you knew the lettering. Intellectually, he knew that if he sounded out an English word like island, he should have to know what the word meant. But something tripped between eyes and brains, and he found himself thinking the Satidan word, Barai. It made the lessons go fast, faster even than he'd anticipated, and much faster than Chuck had. He didn't think Chuck noticed, even after they moved from books to direct conversation, tapping out messages to each other on a pair of linked laptops. It was weird, really. Chuck asked him about missions, and he asked Chuck about gate activity and other teams' experiences departing or returning. They never talked about Canada or Satida, or anything at all personal. And Ronan just thought that they'd take a couple more months and he'd be good when Chuck leaned back from the laptop one day and cocked an eyebrow at him. "You have a photographic memory, don't you?" he asked. Ronan grunted.
"It's good enough."
"It's pretty detailed."
"Yeah, well, gotta know stuff," Ronan said with a shrug, uncertain how to explain.
He remembered a lot. He'd always been top of his class at the training schools, but when you're running from someone who wants to eat you and can find you pretty easily, being able to remember where you are and what gate addresses are safe and which ones lead where was an absolute necessity. Remember or die. "That must have been a big help when you were..." Chuck sketched a shape in the air, a circle, which was apparently supposed to mean, "I don't want to talk about it because it might piss you off and you're huge and dangerous, but hey, just trying to bond here."
"It helped," Ronan said.
"We done?" "Sure, if you want," Chuck answered, giving him a confused look. "Got your reading for the week?" Ronan flashed him the edge of a glossy Earther magazine. Most of the reading material in the city was jargon-filled scientific journals, trashy romance novels. Chuck rejected those out of hand, and Ronan agreed. They'd had similar material on Satida, and just, no. Or Shepard's infamous Russian novel, which Chuck said had stupid complex compound sentences. So he'd asked the Marines for reading material, and they had obligingly provided. "Strictly for the articles," Chuck said, which is what the Marine had said when he'd passed him the magazine.
"If I wanted to look at tits all day, I'd just go back to Planet Naked," Ronan replied, which is what Shepard had taken to calling the planet we don't tell the Marines about, and McKay had referred to as, "That's where I'm moving when I retire."
Taylor, predictably, had gone on about cultural understanding and tropical climates and sucked the fun right out of toplessness. She was right, of course, but it was annoying that he had to feel bad every time he made a joke about Planet Naked. Chuck waved him on with a laugh, and Ronan ambled down to the labs, because if asking Shepard to explain Earther humor was funny, asking McKay to explain Earther's sex humor ought to be awesome. By the time Ronan was typing his own mission reports, very, very slowly, and often with Chuck looking over his shoulder to correct spelling, it had been nearly 8 months since he'd arrived on Atlantis. It was also coming up on July, Earth time, which apparently involved a 2-week celebration of nationalism and independence, from each other or something. As Ronan understood it, the Canadians opened the festivities on the 1st. The United Statesians? United Statesers? Chuck had said it was stupid to call them Americans when, hello, they shared the continent with 2 other countries. Anyway, the United States carried the banner through whatever weekend came next. The Argentinians joined on the 9th, and the French closed with elegant pastry on the 14th. It wasn't really any business of his, and it clearly baffled Taylor as much as it did him. All the celebration over being who you were, when you so clearly were who you were anyway. So he ignored it. Right up until the moment when Chuck and McKay showed up in the sparring room and dragged him almost physically away from training and all but frog-marched him into the mess kitchen at 3 p.m. "It's almost July 1st, Chuck said, as they entered the kitchen. The regular staff was nowhere in sight. Shepard and Taylor were both there, looking perplexed, and a handful of others, only some of whom he recognized. All of them were wearing the Canadian insignia, though. The room smelled like frying things. A huge pot was sitting on the heating unit, and Shepard, incongruously, was chopping up what looked like cheese under the watchful eyes of the Canadians. McKay hurried over to a smaller pot on another heating unit, picking up a whisk and briskly stirring whatever it was, some dark syrupy liquid. Chuck plucked a colander off the counter and went to the pots on the stove, examining them with all the conscientiousness he normally reserved for gate maintenance and malprepares. Someone else began setting out plates.
"Chuck?" McKay asked, with his "have you fixed this yet, imbecile" voice.
"Just about ready," Chuck said, lifting the pot off the stove and pouring it over the colander, which was set on another pot. Ronan recognized what he was cooking now. He was draining the French fries, similar to a Satidan dish made with roots and a thick batter.
"You want to tell us what the hell this is about?"
"I'm indentured labor here," Shepard complained.
"Ladies and gentlemen, honored guests," McKay said pompously, as Chuck began to dole the hot fries onto plates,
We are gathered here today to celebrate the formation of Canada as a federated constitutional...
Oh my God, how long did you practice this speech? One of the women interrupted.
McKay looked annoyed. Fine, happy Canada Day, he said, as Chuck scooped piles of the chopped cheese into his hands and topped the fries with them. Have some poutine. He picked up the pan he'd been stirring and began spooning the whatever it was over the top of each plate. Ronan looked on in faint horror because what was he doing to the fries?
I have not encountered a dish such as this, Taylor said, as McKay offered her the first plate.
Chuck shoved one at Ronan, grinning.
Very traditional Canadian dish, Chuck told her. I mean, it should be cheese curds, not cheese itself. But they have to be fresh, and we're kind of a long way from the nearest Loblaws.
Shepard was already inhaling his, making approving noises around a mouthful of fries and cheese. Ronan managed to get a fair amount of cheese and fries between his fingers and shuffled it into his mouth, the way McKay was doing. Aha! The stuff on the top was gravy.
Is good, he said. Chuck beamed.
It's foul, one of the other Canadians said, picking at his.
It's Canadian. It's good for you, McKay retorted.
Then, with a glance at Taylor,
okay, it's not good for you, but...
Keeps you warm on those long Edmonton nights, Shepard suggested, and McKay rolled his eyes.
Listen, how many times do I have to draw you this map? Toronto is here, McKay said, jabbing a finger in the air. Edmonton is way over here.
Another jab, as far as his arms would stretch.
And I don't care if you were stationed in Calgary for some godforsaken training mission. You were nowhere near Toronto in any way, shape, or form.
Shepard just shrugged. It's pretty close at Mach 2.
We are pleased to share the celebration with you, Taylor broke in, with her best talking to idiots on other planets smile. I am certain that John and Ronan and I feel very welcomed by your Canadian generosity.
When do we get to learn the secret handshake? Shepard asked.
Learn the offside rule in hockey and legalize gay marriage first, McKay replied.
Ah, Rodney, was that a proposal? McKay's face flushed, and Ronan tried to make it look like he was laughing along with the other Canadians, rather than at McKay's total cluelessness. Then a thought occurred to him and he frowned. We're not, like, official Canadians now, right? He said. 'Cause we've done this kind of thing off-world, and then they think we're related or something, and Canada sounds cool and all, but...
Honorary Canadians, McKay said, except Shepard.
You can be Canadian whenever you want, Chuck said to Ronan. You just have to learn the national anthem. Oh, God, Shepard tilted his head to the heavens. But it was too late. Three of the Canadians had burst into song, and the rest joined in quickly. Oh, Canada... Our home and native land, true patriot, love of all thy sons command. Taylor was laughing helplessly at Shepard's face, and probably at McKay, who had a surprisingly good tenor and was conducting with a gravy-drenched french fry. With glowing hearts we see thee rise, the true north strong and free. From far and wide, O Canada, we stand on guard for thee. Chuck had joined in, completely off-key, and Ronan didn't know the words, but it didn't seem like he needed to. Everyone else was happy, and the poutine was pretty good, and someone was singing a national anthem again, even if it wasn't his. It was kind of cool, if you like that sort of thing. Ronan found English lessons with Chuck to be soothing, in a strange way. Even after he was pretty much totally literate, they'd seek each other out once or twice a week and sit in the mess tapping messages to each other on their tablets. It was good typing practice, anyway. And Chuck said if he wanted, he'd show him the one-handed keyboard method so that he could type while, say, shooting bad guys with his blaster. The blaster spinning lessons had become almost a bone of contention, because clearly Chuck was practicing without him. He was almost as fast as Ronan by the time a year had passed, though that didn't really mean anything. His blaster wasn't real, and it wasn't balanced like the real thing, because Ronan didn't let anyone touch his guns. It wasn't that he thought Chuck would accidentally shoot himself. It was just that they were his guns. You weren't supposed to let another soldier touch your gun unless there was a real and valid reason that they had to. And then came the Planet of the Apes. Technically, they were more like orangutans. At least that's what McKay said. Having had a close, personal, and explosive encounter with one, he was in a position to know. Primates are supposed to be gentle, Shepard said, pulling the body off McKay.
Did they get that memo?
Oof, Jesus, McKay answered as he wiggled free.
Haven't you seen Congo?
No. But I did see Planet of the Apes, Shepard drawled, and the name stuck. McKay scrambled up onto a rock and took a minute to put his head between his knees and breathe while Shepard pushed onward.
The gunfire seemed to have frightened the rest of the animals away from the temple or warehouse or bunker they'd been investigating when the orangutan decided to assert his masculinity. Ronan stood on the rock behind him and kept an eye out while Taylor swept up from below. After a minute, they heard Shepard on the radio. "Hey guys, you gotta come see this," he said.
"What, now?" McKay asked wearily.
"I just got really inappropriately turned on," Shepard replied, and reappeared at the door of the building with the biggest, most awesome gun Ronan had ever seen.
"Vastly inappropriate," McKay agreed,
but Ronan had a personal moment over the sheer firepower that thing probably packed. "It's an arms warehouse. Come see," Shepard invited. The building was dim, but with their sights lights on, they could see plenty. The gleam of metal on every wall, off glass, over cases full of knives, and racks full of every weapon Ronan had ever seen, and quite a few he hadn't. Shepard opened his pack, shoved the contents around, and began loading. "We can send a team back for the rest," he said, passing a handful of click grenades to McKay, who rolled his eyes but stowed them anyway. Taylor was eyeing the knives covetously. Then Ronan saw it, the chest in the corner with the weird writing on the side. The same writing you could see engraved on the blaster if you tilted it and let the light hit it just right. He crouched, clicked the latches, opened it. "Hoo boy," he said, gazing in on the contents. "Dibs."
"Dibs?" Shepard asked, raising an eyebrow.
Ronan pulled out three perfect, fully charged blasters.
"Oh, no way. I've wanted one of those forever."
"Called him," Ronan replied, shoving two in his belt. He tossed the third to McKay, who looked terrified before he caught it. "Take that one apart. Build us some more." McKay caught Shepard's eye. They both grinned. They came back through the gate looking more like a well-prepared mobile army than an expedition team. From the looks on the faces of the Marines on gate duty, Shepard wasn't the only one feeling a little inappropriate. Shepard went to prepare a briefing for the recovery team. McKay presented Cadman one of the click grenades as if it was a proposal of marriage. Cadman accepted it with about the same amount of dignity. And Taylor wandered off, presumably to find a way of testing the sharpness of the knives bristling from her pack straps. Ronan pulled out one of the blasters from his belt, keyed the double lock deactivation, and climbed the stairs.
"Don't kill anyone," he said, and offered it grips first to Chuck.
"Seriously?" Chuck asked. "I mean, really? Seriously?"
"Seriously, don't kill anyone," Ronan appended, and walked off with a grin. Chuck was immediately surrounded by a knot of admirers.
He waited until 20 minutes after Chuck was scheduled to go off shift, and then went down to the firing range. Chuck was there already, bleeding in three places from where the hinge was catching his hands, being alternately admired and mocked by what must be every off-duty Marine in the city.
"You guys, out," Ronan growled, and the room cleared.
"You suck with the real thing, Chuck."
"Not for long," Chuck said, a demonic glow in his eyes. "Show me how to shoot it."
2 years into Ronan's stay on Atlantis, they invented a new game to test McKay's first gangling, inelegant prototype for the blaster.
"Ready?" Shepard asked, shifting balance from foot to foot, fingers gripping the handle of the golf club.
"Are you sure this thing's not going to blow off my hand?" Ronan asked McKay.
"Are you worried? You have a spare," McKay said, which was his way of saying yes. "Pull!" Shepard shouted, and the golf ball went arcing through the air towards the water.
Ronan brought the prototype up and fired. The golf ball burst into flaming fragments and rained down into gentle lapping waves.
"You know," Shepard said, propping the club between deck and hand like a cane,
"whatever anyone says about McKay..."
"Standing right here," McKay called.
"You can't deny he builds an awesome blaster."
"Can we do it again?" Lorne asked.
Zelenka hadn't yet stopped staring at the place where the ex-golf ball had been destroyed. Taylor was, apparently, more interested in testing the balance and potential lethality of Shepard's 9-iron. Shepard smiled and teed up another ball. The blasters never really took off among the Marines, if only because the models McKay put out, while sleeker than his prototype, were still hard to carry and didn't so much have the stun and kill settings as they did the sting and set on fire. Ronan began practicing two-handed blaster spinning, and to his great satisfaction, heard Chuck turning down large bribes for the use of his own.
"I'm going to tell you what a wise man once told me," he said solemnly to the little knot of Marines.
"What's that?" one of them asked.
"You can't touch my gun," Chuck replied, and sauntered off.
As far as nearly everyone was concerned, the head gate tech of Atlantis carrying a blaster was a total waste of an awesome weapon. He didn't go off-world, and the only time he ever fired it was on the range. The fact that he got dispensation from Elizabeth the Carriot holstered on his hip while he was in the gate room only added insult to the injury. Right up until a group of wraith-worshipping assholes decided to invade Atlantis through the gate.
Later, when they'd worked out what had happened, they agreed that 1, those morons would never have gotten past the gate room, 2, they could, however, have slaughtered everyone inside it, and 3, morons they may have been, but ill-prepared they were not. They targeted one of the lower echelon teams, disarmed them, intimidated their scientists into dialing Atlantis with his IDC. "You are fired," was the only thing McKay said for the rest of the day after finding this out, and came in guns blazing. Ronan, who'd been working on an Earther crossword with his feet up on the console, mainly to irritate Chuck, was on the floor in an instant, firing through the legs of the chairs. He didn't even realize another blaster had joined his until he looked up and saw Chuck crouched behind the DHD, one eye squinted like he always did on the range. It was all over faster than most people could react to what was happening. Colonel Carter hadn't even left her office to find out what the hell was going on. Ronan watched Chuck spin the blaster effortlessly. A nice clean single half twist. And holster it before diving under the DHD to make sure none of the crystals were cracked. He was still at work on it when Ronan came back from the infirmary, where they'd taken the one Marine who'd been shot by the invaders. The team had been hijacked by them and the invaders themselves. "Anyone dead?" Chuck asked when he saw him coming.
"Not yet," Ronan said. "If they suddenly die in their sleep overnight, I was with you the whole time, okay?"
"Okay," Chuck said agreeably.
"Nice shooting, by the way."
"Yeah, I thought I did all right," Chuck said, closing the bullet dented panel. "And man, you know what?"
"What?" Ronan asked. Chuck grinned.
"I am going to get so much tail when word gets out." PSX-992 was another the planet of. In this case, the planet of the McKays. Taylor didn't know why her father had stopped trading with the Tenarians, but she assured them that there were no reports anywhere in the galaxy of the Tenarians being actually violent, and Ronan's recon backed it up. They sent Lauren's team in, and they'd been there for maybe an hour when Lauren radioed back that Colonel Shepard should come meet the Tenarians, and also they wanted to talk to Dr. McKay.
"How do they know who Dr. McKay is?" Shepard asked. "They don't, but trust me," Lauren said. "McKay's the one they want to talk to."
The Tenarians, as it turned out, had been blessed at one time with the presence of an extremely irritable ancient who had left them several commandments, including breed for intelligence, don't ask stupid questions, and sarcasm shall be the way. The woman that Lauren had first spoken to, who Shepard finally called Michaela whenever they were out of earshot, greeted them with annoyance and didn't look up from the water pump she was repairing until Ronan moved to stand in front of it. Then she did look up and got a comically startled look on her face. "Hello, big person," she said, blinking. "Please don't kill me."
"Okay," Ronan replied, but continued to loom until Rodnina, Shepard's other name for her, agreed to take them to the mayor.
Along the way, she talked nonstop, extolling and possibly exaggerating the virtues of their settlement, asking tactless questions, and answering all of theirs with sharp remarks and eye rolls. McKay looked like he was a little bit in love. Kayla found the Tenarians totally immune to her diplomatic style, dismissing her out of hand the first time she said something that might politely bend the truth just slightly. And this was, of course, the whole point of bringing McKay. Except McKay had been hustled off to a wall panel where he was arguing heatedly and indecently with a local scientist about the best method of rewiring the whatever it was behind it.
"Hey, I got an idea," Shepard said. "Let me try."
"Colonel," Taylor began, but her wits had pretty much deserted her back at the negotiation table when one of the Tenarians had looked at her, asked if she had some kind of brain damage, and demanded to know how much she knew, if anything, about transspatial matter inversion nodes. The answer, of course, was nothing, but then Shepard didn't know anything about it either.
"So," Shepard said, seating himself and tossing his legs up on the negotiating table, "you have cocoa beans."
The Tenarians gave him a sardonic look.
"We need cocoa beans. We make some really cool stuff with them," Shepard added, digging into his vest for a snack-sized Snickers bar and tossing it across.
The Tenarians peeled it open, tasted it, and squinted.
"In case you hadn't noticed, we are a bean-based industry here. We need the beans ourselves."
"Yeah, you're doing really well with all the beans," Shepard replied, looking faintly amused.
"And the total lack of bread or vegetables or, you know, meat. That's not going to be problematic."
With that laconic smackdown, it was on. Ronan watched as Shepard took skills honed in 3 years of poking, prodding, annoying, insulting, and cajoling McKay, and spun them into a 2-hour rapid-fire bickering match that netted them 18 precious crates of processed almost cocoa beans. McKay practically destroyed half the town's egos and made like a million friends. Let friends equal people who seemed to enjoy shouting at him, and decided that if he could introduce the Tenarians to the people on Planet Naked, he'd retire now.
Well, the negotiator finally said with put-upon dignity, and Ronan sighed with relief. I suppose that's acceptable. Great, Shepard smiled. We'll have the livestock delivered in 3 days.
3 days? 3 days, It will take 3 days simply to gather, the man replied, looking offended. And Shepard put up a hand to forestall the tirade.
Get it done, okay, he said, and got up from the table.
Ah, said Michaela from the doorway, shooting nervous looks at Ronan. There's one other thing.
Shepard looked extremely unamused.
You may have noticed a slight tendency in our people to, debate, she said.
I wasn't going to say anything, Ronan assured her, deadpan.
Well, we don't get much trade. I don't know why. Everyone in this galaxy are idiots or really delicate or something, she said. But we put a lot of value on, you know, ideas and intelligence and healthy intellectual intercourse.
Did I miss anything? McKay asked, approaching from the street, tail tagging after him. Dinner? She wants intercourse, Ronan called. Everyone in the room blushed.
We'd like to request a public debate. It's a tradition when we meet someone we feel really understands snaring tradition, like Colonel Shepard and Dr. McKay do, she continued doggedly. It's not very complicated. We would assemble our people in the square and appoint an opponent for Dr. McKay, and they would, go at it. Not like that, intellectually, she said to McKay, who was gaping at her. We consider it a promise of good faith.
I think it's idiotic, the negotiator said.
Did I ask you? Michaela demanded.
Just because you haven't the native wit to ask me.
Native wit's all you have to offer. You stick to bean sales.
Okay, Shepard said, stepping between them. Rodney? McKay was still looking startled. You want to indulge in a little intellectual stimulation?
There's a feast afterwards, Michaela added.
McKay sniffed.
If they feel they have someone equipped to debate on my level. I like that, Michaela whirled on him. We're not backwards peasants, you know. Hey, like half your stuff wasn't working when I got here. Because you have the gene, light switch.
The mayor clapped his hands together. Excellent. Let us move this stimulating conversation into the public square, shall we? McKay had spent a long time working for the military, and had probably been born an asshole, and, given the opportunity to really let loose, he had an impressive vocabulary. Ronan kept expecting someone to burst into tears or shoot him or something, but as he sat in the square and watched McKay and Michaela heap insults on each other, he had to admit that he could understand why the only tears were in the audience, and they were tears of admiration. Shepard taped the whole thing without telling anyone, and made a highlights reel that circulated like wildfire in Atlantis. Ronan felt obscurely proud of McKay, and the fact that people in two galaxies were now aware of the extemporaneous debating skills of the Canadian tribe. Ronan politely did not tell anyone about the look he saw in Shepard's face when McKay was gaining the upper hand in the debate, because some things were private, and none of his business. My Home and Native Land, Part 3, by Copper Badge, written for the Live Journal community, I Defeated SGA, read by Julie I. Wolf. At Queenston Heights and Lundy's Lane, our brave fathers side by side, for freedom's homes and loved one dears, firmly stood and nobly died. Don't think about it, Ronan advised, as Chuck tried a simple spin toss at the blaster, and once again bruised an already tender area of his knuckles. You gotta just do it till your muscles know how.
Yeah, Chuck sighed. My muscles are kind of dumb right now.
Think about other stuff. Start a spin, Ronan said. And Chuck began flipping the blaster around one hand, spinning and clicking it across the hinges, holstering it only to flick it up back out again. Ronan joined in a few seconds, then stopped and smacked the back of Chuck's head when he frowned in concentration.
Maybe I've, you know, achieved my peak, Chuck said, in the realm of juggling dangerous weaponry. I mean, I'm pretty good as it is.
You gotta stop thinking, Ronan repeated. Come on, give me some poetry.
I'm fresh out of memorized stuff, you've heard it all, Chuck said. But he holstered the blaster and pulled his tablet off his belt, hanging it on a headphone rack on the firing range wall. He scrolled through a list of files and picked one seemingly at random. Ronan moved to stand next to him so they could read together. I met a traveler from an antique land who said, two vast and trunkless legs of stone stand in the desert, near them on the sand. Chuck started spinning again, and then doing simple hand-to-hand tosses. Half-sunk, a shattered visage lies, whose frown and wrinkled lip and sneer of cold command tell that those passions, well the sculptor read, which yet survive, stamped on these lifeless things. The hand that mocked them and the heart that fed.
Ronan cut his eyes sideways for a moment as Chuck executed a perfect spin toss and then another backed into the original hand.
And on that pedestal these words appear, My name is Ozymandias, King of Kings.
Look on my work, ye mighty, and despair. Nothing beside remains. Chuck tossed the blaster up, let it go for 3 complete rotations, and caught it out of the air. Round the decay of that colossal wreck, boundless and bare, the lone and level sands stretched far away. Every time Chuck spun, from then on, Ronan could see the barest hint of movement at his lips as he recited. Well, whatever kept you going, he supposed. Their last mission before Taylor was taken by Michael involved a snow-covered planet with no inhabitants at all, but the possibility of an Aquita mine. They found the mine easily enough, because Ronan fell straight through the ice and into it, and McKay landed on top of him, and then so did a whole bunch of snow. Ronan, McKay, Shepard's voice through the radio.
Okay, seriously, McKay answered. I have totally filled my quota of death by mineshaft moments already. Did you have to pull me in with you, potholes decks?
Relax, Buckaroo Banzai, Shepard replied over the radio. Where are you guys?
Under some snow, Ronan answered. 20 feet, maybe 25.
You got air? Got your equipment?
Ronan looked around. The shaft was small and narrow, and blocked by a solid sheet of ice, creating a small chamber. They probably had 8 or 9 hours' worth of air, and they both had their packs.
We're good, Ronan said.
We are so far from good.
Can it, McKay, Shepard said. We're going back to the gate. We'll get some engineers out here with shovels. Sit tight and cuddle for warmth.
Shepard, don't you dare leave us! Shepard, don't you dare!
McKay cut off suddenly as the snow squealed, shifting and showering them with ice.
Son of a bitch!
Shepard'll get us out, Ronan said, edging up against McKay's shoulder and pulling the pack off. You got thermal blankets? They managed to arrange themselves against a wall of rock rather than snow, wrapped in thermal foil blankets, shoulder to shoulder. McKay complained the whole time in an undertone designed to demonstrate both his fear of further cave-ins and possibly his future as a crazy, muttering, mad scientist, until Ronan got annoyed.
Don't you stop to breathe, he asked.
I am breathing as little as possible in order to conserve air, McKay retorted.
Yeah, except you're talking, which is wasting air.
Excuse me for having coping mechanisms. I'm trying not to get frostbite or fall asleep here. Since cards are pretty much out and I left my PlayStation back on Earth, I'm a little pressed for entertainment.
I could distract you, Ronan said.
I really don't think Prime Not Prime is your game.
I know other stuff. You know Robert Service?
McKay twisted around and looked at him.
I'm sorry, did you just say Robert Service?
I can't know Robert Service, Ronan asked, honestly intrigued. Maybe it was a secret Canadian thing.
Where the hell did you learn about?
Chuck taught me.
McKay barked out a sharp laugh.
Yeah, it'd be him.
I have good recall. I could tell you Sam McGee. Sounds like McKay, Ronan grinned fairly. The night on the marge of Lake LaBarge, I cremated Mayor McKay.
Okay, now you're officially freaking me out. And also, you do not get to call me Mayor.
Well, if you don't know it.
I don't know. Hey, he's my cultural heritage, you syncretic freak of nature. I know Sam McGee. I had to memorize it for.
Grade 10 English?
McKay looked annoyed.
Grade 6. Waste of colossal time, and now it's stuck in my head, where there could be Nobel Prize-winning mathematics.
Bet you don't, Ronan challenged, pleased with himself.
McKay was well and thoroughly distracted, and also looked warmer.
I know Robert Service, Ronan the Barbarian.
Prove it.
McKay rolled his eyes.
There are strange things done neath the midnight sun by the men who moil for gold. The Arctic trails have their secret tales that would make your blood run cold. The northern lights have seen strange sights, but the strangest they ever did see was the night on the marge of Lake LaBarge I cremated Sam McGee.
Sam McGee was from Tennessee, where the cotton blooms and blows, Ronan joined in. It felt good. It felt like a chant, like something the regiment would do. Not this story, maybe, but the rhythm was right.
A promise made is a debt unpaid, and the trail has its own stern code. In the days to come, though my lips were dumb, in my heart how I cursed that load.
McKay's teeth chattered a little, but chattering was all right. When they stopped shivering, that'd be when the trouble started. In the long, long night, by the lone firelight, while the huskies, round in a ring, howled out their woes to the homeless snows.
Oh God, how I loathe the thing, they said in unison.
They recited the whole poem, right up through Sam McGee being stuffed into a makeshift crematorium. McKay only tripped up once, and that was on the funny verse, where he couldn't remember,
"Plum tree down in Tennessee," before, "It's the first time I've been warm."
Ronan whooped enthusiastically when they finished. McKay laughed a little, even, and elbowed him in the ribs.
"I don't know if it's all the time you spend hanging out with Chuck, or my own genius," he said solemnly, "but you have the soul of a Canadian, Ronan."
And that was when they heard Shepard shout, "Look out below!" And a rain of snow and ice, the roof caved in. Good times, man. The explosion at Michael's creepy-as-fuck nursery for Taylor's unborn baby put Shepard in the infirmary unconscious, killed three of the Marines, and nearly caused McKay the loss of an arm. Ronan vibrated with fury, and nobody would go near him. He threw himself into the database in a frenzy and spent equal amounts of time running the city's pathways and hunching over a computer to glean anything he could about recent Wraith sightings and activity. He was therefore totally unprepared for the message that popped up from Chuck on his tablet in the middle of the afternoon. It was a stark, quick sentence. Unshed, off-world, activation. IDC, Temagin. Ronan bolted for the gate room, arriving just in time to see the Wraith Dart ship emerging from the wormhole. Everyone in the room, Chuck included, had their firearms trained on it. As he joined them, the cockpit slid back, and Taylor's tawny brown hair caught the light. Ronan burst through the Marines and climbed the dart without waiting for it to land, clinging to the edge and pulling Taylor into an awkward half-in, half-out hug. She patted his cheek affectionately and then gave him a gentle shove.
"My people," she said quietly. "My people are stored in the machine."
Ronan leapt backwards and watched as the dart lifted into the air and a beam of white light produced a ragged gang, a dozen, perhaps two dozen, who looked around them in startled amazement. They were clinging to each other, huddled in a tight knot, a damaged but united tribe. The survivors of Athos. Not more in number than the survivors of Setida, but no longer scattered to the winds. Ronan ran to the jumper bay to greet Taylor properly, forehead to forehead, and then dragged her to the infirmary, where Keller checked her over, and then took her to see Shepard and McKay. That was a good tribe, too, the four of them, McKay holding on to Taylor tightly with his uninjured hand, her other resting on Shepard's chest, Ronan leaning on the edge of Shepard's bed while the infirmary outside the small room bustled with the healing and the care of the rest of the Thosians. Ronan knew that McKay and Shepard weren't intending to be so obvious. Shepard was notoriously unaware about this kind of thing, though Ronan thought possibly much of that came from, you know, not being interested in women. McKay wasn't unaware. He just wasn't very good with people, so he didn't bother much with the opinion of people who weren't in his immediate orbit. Ronan, Taylor, Shepard, Keller, Carter, Zelenka. "I'm running a book," Chuck said, sitting down across from Ronan, tilting his head at the wide glass windows at the other end of the mess. McKay and Shepard were sitting at one of the tables there, having some kind of heated argument, which was probably their version of foreplay, McKay gesturing with his bandaged hand. "I need your help calculating odds."
"What on?" Ronan asked.
"Shepard and McKay. Are they doing it?"
Ronan finished chewing before he answered.
"Who wants to know?"
"Everybody."
"They're on my team," Ronan said significantly. It didn't have to be spoken aloud. "Don't fuck with my team." "Like anyone cares about it," Chuck rolled his eyes. "Half the Marines are betting they are, and if they were the assholes they are generally painted to be, they'd already have taken Shepard out for a beating. This is Pegasus. Nobody gives a fuck. Does that mean you know?"
Ronan shrugged. "It's not like they'd go at it in front of me."
"But?"
"They probably want to be if they aren't."
Chuck gave the pair a measuring look.
"Neat love story."
Ronan nodded. He put some thought into this. "Not the one you think, though." Chuck raised an eyebrow.
"Oh?"
"You think it's Shepard and McKay, but it's not," Ronan continued. "I've been watching movies."
"Oh, God. What did they inflict on you?"
"No, I get it," Ronan protested. "It's a classic. In my home, too." This stopped Chuck cold, as he was about to launch into a diatribe about popular film. Chuck was a hardcore Nor fan, whatever Nor was.
"Boy meets boy?" he asked.
"No," Ronan answered disdainfully. "It's not about them."
"What's it about?"
"Atlantis," Ronan said, gesturing with his fork. "It's classic. Pretty girl has to choose between the jock and the..."
"Oh my God!" Chuck covered his mouth to keep from laughing. "The jock and the geek!"
"Yeah. And everybody's always supposed to root for the underdog." Chuck scowled.
"Ducky was robbed," he said darkly,
which was some reference Ronan was going to have to call him on at some later date. "Atlantis is the girl, and they're chasing her," Ronan said. "McKay's winning, by the way."
"How do you figure?"
"He's the one people call when they want her fixed."
"But shouldn't they hate each other's guts then, McKay and Shepard?"
"Fine line," Ronan said, grinning.
Chuck said and sipped his water.
They're totally doing it, then.
Yeah, probably, Ronan and paused. McKay-Sig dudes can get married in Canada.
Yeah, that's true, Chuck got that look he got. Whenever he felt he was being one-sided about all this cultural exchange and wanted to ask Ronan about Satita, but thought it might annoy him. It was kind of amusing, in an awesome sort of way.
On Satita, marriage was about kids, he said. So we didn't have a lot of rules about it. If you got married, you were going to have kids. If you were going to adopt a kid, you had to find someone to marry. Chuck frowned.
So, like, you didn't have to be in love?
Ronan shrugged. I'm just saying nobody cared. You could marry your best friend as long as they were going to help you raise the kids. Who you hung out with was your own business.
Well, that seems enlightened.
Earthers are weird about sex.
You're telling me. I'm the one taking bets on whether my boss is sleeping with Colonel Shepherd.
Ronan's literary tastes were pretty Catholic, and after a while he broke away from Chuck's recommendations and began reading on his own. One particular Daedalus delivery for him carried 3 Stephen King novels, a translated Plato's Republic, and a book called The Group of 7, which was about Canadians. Ronan thought it was probably their version of The Dirty Dozen. Turned out, not so much. There wasn't even that much to read, but that didn't matter, because Ronan sat in the mess with the cellophane wrapper still crumpled next to him, and ate without looking at his food as he pored over the full-colored reproduced paintings that the Group of 7 had done. The book said they were a part of the Canadian national identity, but this wasn't the Canada he'd seen. It was all wilderness and mountains and houses that looked like Satita's plankboard weathered paint surrounded by scraggly windblown trees. There were huge rock formations and nude portraits. They were weird and vibrant, and Lauren Harris is painted like he'd known Atlantis, all smooth, crisp angles and rounded corners. "What you looking at?" Shepherd asked, sliding into the seat across from him. "Looks like chocolate cake."
"It's a mountain," Ronan informed him.
"Of chocolate cake?"
Ronan sniffed.
"It's Canadian."
"Canadian chocolate cake?"
"Dude, seriously, no wonder McKay's so high-strung," Ronan remarked, and Shepherd shut his mouth and stared at him.
"No wonder I'm what?" McKay asked, setting his tray down next to Shepherd. "Is that the Group of 7?"
"Yeah," Ronan said, turning the book around and offering it. McKay waved it away with a spoon.
"Not interested. Lauren Harris always makes me think of chocolate cake."
Shepherd looked supremely vindicated. Ronan just rolled his eyes. McKay offered him his juice bottle, and Ronan obligingly inched his baked potato off his plate and onto McKay's tray.
"Taylor,"
Shepherd called, and Ronan looked over his shoulder. Taylor was standing at the serving table, helping herself to a sandwich and some potato chips, Tolan slung in a knotted shawl around her shoulders. She joined them, carefully shifting the baby out of the way of the table, and in so doing, directly into McKay's arms.
"Thanks," McKay said sourly, but he clutched the kid as if too much freedom of movement might kill it.
"Your turn anyway," Shepherd said.
"I thought this was your job after you lost the rock-paper-scissors for doting godfather," McKay retorted.
"Won, McKay. I won. You're the one who's allergic to kids."
"I just don't see why we have to interact with beings whose brains and chemical bodily functions haven't fully developed," McKay replied, trying in vain to get a hand on his spoon and still maintain his death grip on Tolan. "If you're so happy about it, you take him."
"I have a sandwich in my hand," Shepherd said, picking up his sandwich. McKay gave him a withering look. "Plato says parents shouldn't raise their own kids," Ronan heard himself say. "He says the state should do it, so they all think the same way." Everyone at the table looked at him. "Plato's kind of full of crap," he added.
"Two vast but accurate oversimplifications," McKay observed. "Besides, it doesn't account for genius. Exceptional people require exceptional education."
"Are you saying my child is exceptional, Rodney?" Taylor asked, smiling. "First native-born Atlantean citizen, stick-fighting alien princess for a mother, suicidal thrill-junkie mathlete for a godfather, Uncle Ronan keeps knives in his hair and recites poetry, and Uncle Rodney's a future Nobel Prize winner who, if Tolan is very good and doesn't puke on him too much, we'll teach him how to build bombs when he's older. If he isn't exceptional, it won't be our fault," McKay said.
"Yeah, he's Atlantean, isn't he?" Shepherd said thoughtfully.
"He is a Thosian first," Taylor reminded them. It took Ronan a minute to understand that she meant he was the child of the Athosians, nothing more. He listened as McKay bickered with Taylor about Tolan's future upbringing, but his head was elsewhere. Cut up in the problem he kept having, which was that nobody actually belonged to Atlantis as a tribe, not even him. And that still left him tribeless after the destruction of Satita. Atlantis wasn't actually a country, no matter how much it united the people living there. And besides, it also antagonized them and routinely tried to kill them all.
It didn't have a flag or standing independent army. It didn't even have a national food like poutine or Big Macs, though he supposed that they could count the giant carnivorous and delicious bat things that Shepard uncovered in the lower levels of the city. No national anthem, no tribal standards or tattoos. Not a real country. Still, Ronan wanted it to be, because then he could be a citizen there. Satito was fading from his memory, and perhaps that was just as well. He'd listened to the anthropologist talking about preserving heritage and native arts and all the rest of it, but he thought Satito should be laid in peace. She deserved that much, his home world. He was pretty sure that he'd never be evicted from Atlantis again, not without dying first. But if he was, he made the decision that he wasn't going to go back to the Athosians and Tayla. Tayla was fine, but the Athosians made him jumpy, weren't like him, weren't his people. Except Tayla, and maybe Tolan. Maybe Chuck would let him crash in Canada for a while. Think, Ronan. Ronan looked up guiltily from his soup. Huh? 6 too young to teach someone how to fly a puddle jumper, Shepard repeated. No 6-year-old is going anywhere near a jumper, McKay insisted. Hey, my dad let me drive his Mustang when I was 6, Shepard made a steering motion. You know, sitting on his lap. And was your dad's Mustang capable of direct neural interface and multiple G's of acceleration? Do you want the kid brain damaged for life? Ancient kids must have used their technology all the time, Shepard pointed out. Yeah, and let's look at some of the ancient's brilliant ideas, like computer-assisted ascension, time-warp booby traps, and unsecured biohazards areas filled with horrible viri, McKay replied. Forgive me for not trusting them with Tolan's delicate growing neurons. Ronan wasn't too worried about Tolan Amigan. He had Taylor to teach him about being an Athosian and fighting and diplomacy, and Ronan could help with the fighting, and maybe get him his first tattoo. And Shepard and McKay could teach him math and other stuff. The point was, Tolan had a family and a country, and Ronan had the team for family, but he felt a little stupid lacking something that a 2-month-old baby had. My Home and Native Land, Part 4 out of 4, by Copper Badge, written for the Live Journal community, I Defeated SGA, read by Julie I. Wolfe. And may those ties of love be ours, which discord cannot sever, and flourish green from freedom's home, the maple leaf, forever.
I want to be a Canadian, Ronan said in the gate room one day, and Chuck looked at him aghast over the edge of the DHD.
You want to what? He demanded.
Be a Canadian, Ronan said. What?
Oh my God, Chuck said faintly. I'm a missionary.
Ronan read about missionaries when he read James Michener. Hawaii sounded nice, and he wanted to see it sometime, though not as much as he wanted to see Prince Edward Isle after reading Anne of Green Gables, which nobody told him was a girly book, assholes, until he offered to lend it to Shepard and McKay, and McKay fell off his lab stool, laughing. The missionaries in Hawaii didn't seem like very nice people, but if that was Chuck's religion, he'd roll with it.
You are, he asked, just to be sure. I am. Oh my God, I am. Chuck still looked upset. I taught you English and never even asked to learn Satetan, and I evangelized Canada to you, and now you want to give up your culture and become a Canadian. I'm a missionary for Canada. I'm a social imperialist. I've destroyed your heritage.
Ronan said, getting it, and then, no. I think the Wraith did that. Chuck looked even more upset at this, so Ronan decided to work on what Taylor called his communication skills, or lack thereof.
Satita's dead, he said.
You gotta give up stuff when you live with the Wraith. I'm tired of missing it. I want to be part of a tribe again. Chuck's unhappy look faded into a more puzzled frown.
This tribe? He asked, tapping the flag on his shoulder.
Canada's not a tribe, McKay announced, dropping onto a chair next to him. He plugged one of the exposed crystals from the control table into his tablet and started doing something fiddly with the touchscreen.
What are we talking about?
Ronan wants to be a Canadian, Chuck said. McKay looked up, dumbfounded.
Why?
I like Canada, Ronan said. I've been there. You guys are pretty cool. McKay seemed pleased at being esteemed pretty cool, but the doubtful expression hadn't quite left his face.
You've been to Vancouver, and you spent the whole time intimidating people into not killing me. Not that I'm not grateful, but Canada's kind of bigger than Vancouver.
I like poutine, Ronan said, and I get the offside rule in hockey.
McKay shot Chuck a look, and he held his hands up in a gesture of innocence. I didn't teach him. I didn't even know he liked hockey.
Tim Hortons, Ronan said, and both of the other men got distant, nostalgic looks for a minute. Ronan once ate 5 Tim Hortons sandwiches in a sitting, while Shepard and McKay, Jeannie, and her husband, what's-his-name, looked on in awe, and Madison nibbled, huge eyes on a cruller.
I'm good. I pick Canada. What do I have to do?
Chuck rubbed the back of his head. I don't know. I think the SGC could probably just fake you up some Canadian citizenship papers.
There's no, like, rite of passage, Ronan asked.
There's a citizenship exam, McKay said doubtfully. I think they ask you what colors are on the flag.
Seriously, you guys have some kind of low standards.
Can you imagine a Canadian rite of initiation? Chuck asked, grinning suddenly. Very politely blindfolded, driven out to some field outside Calgary,
McKay snorted. Tap 3 times with a hockey stick,
asked to swear on each province by name,
in Quebecois,
and then given a loony to hang around your neck. While you sing the national anthem, McKay finished.
I know the national anthem, Rona muttered.
Chuck, McKay snapped his fingers and made a circling gesture. I need one more hand. It's attached to your arm.
Chuck gave Ronan a long-suffering look and crossed to the control table, crawling underneath it to open the lower access hatch.
You know, he said conversationally, given that they were super telekinetic geniuses and all, you'd think they'd make this crap easier to get to.
They probably didn't need to open the access panels at all.
Then why install them? Ronan asked. Personal theory? The ancients had a secret super-secret slave race they made do all the gross and boring jobs, Chuck replied.
Yeah, they're called Marines, McKay said. And they were still snickering when Colonel Carter approached.
Gentlemen, she announced, with one of those weird smiles she got, like she'd like to be in on the joke but knew better than to ask.
Rodney, Ronan, can I see you guys in the conference room for a minute?
Working, McKay replied in sing-song.
Is it life and death?
That depends. Whose life? McKay asked. If I drop this crystal, it'll start a chain reaction that will probably set Chuck on fire.
Do not want, Chuck called from underneath the console.
When you're done not setting Chuck on fire, then.
Ronan, she said.
Ronan tipped his chair forward and followed her into the conference room, which was already half full. Shepard and Lorne were doing the sulky leaning thing they did. Zelenka was working away as happily there as he would have been in the lab, sitting next to a quiet Taylor and an anxiously fidgeting Keller.
I could go maim McKay into obedience, Shepard offered, when he saw Ronan was alone.
Sometimes that's the only way, he added protestingly, when Taylor and Zelenka glared at him.
Apparently whatever he's doing involves deliberately not setting someone else on fire, Colonel Carter said. I think we're fine starting without him.
She paused and drew a deep breath, which probably pretty much always meant bad news.
A coded communique came through to me early this morning from Dr. Jackson at the Stargate Command, she began.
We weren't scheduled for a data burst, Shepard said.
I know. He felt it couldn't wait. The IOA decided 2 days ago to send representatives from Earth through the space bridge to assess our progress in Pegasus.
Oh, great, Keller said, then flushed bright red. From the looks around the room, however, she was only saying what everyone else was thinking.
Yeah, they're scheduled to arrive next week. We were scheduled to be informed about 2 hours before they showed up. Ladies and gentlemen, I think we're being screwed with.
Gee, that's unexpected, Shepard drawled. You want us to screw back?
With enthusiasm. I'd like to slate some demonstrations for them, to keep them busy and out of from underfoot. Marine drills, that kind of thing, she said. Taylor, if you feel your people are up to it, I thought the IOA representatives might enjoy a show of negative Pegasus galaxy culture.
Something long, Taylor said. Time-consuming.
Something like that.
I know of several worlds that would be happy to provide entertainment in the form of ritual dances, Taylor continued, and prayers of welcome and goodwill.
Oh, please, do. Dr. Keller?
I could give a really interesting lecture on ancient medical technology, Keller beamed.
I bet you could. Shepard, do you still have the tape of McKay doing that debate?
Like 8 copies, Shepard's grin outshone even Keller's.
A tour of the labs, Zelenka suggested.
That'd be great, but maybe we can clean up the...
Explosive machinery, yes, absolutely. I'm certain Rodney will also have many ideas.
Nobody talks like Rodney, Shepard muttered.
Please, feel free to submit applications for any activities you think might be of any interest at all to the members of the IOA, Carter said, looking proud. And make sure everything is spotless and everyone has bright, shining faces.
Let's go beat the Marines, Shepard said to Lorne. What do you think? Maybe 2 or 3 hours of drills for our guests?
We could fly them over the mainland, show off the really big snakes, Lorne agreed as they left.
All right. Let's force-feed them Atlantis, Carter said. Get to it.
Oh, Ronan.
Yeah, Ronan asked, waiting while the others streamed out.
I'd like you to be their personal tour guide. You know,
make sure they know they can come to you with any questions or problems they're having. And of course, keep the blasters on. We want to make sure they feel safe."
Ronan gave her his best, terrifying the newbie's grin. "I can do that," he said. "And I got one or two ideas of my own."
"Oh yeah?"
"Yeah," Ronan nodded. "I'm gonna need some golf balls, though."
There were two separate schedules for the IOA representative's visit to Atlantis. The first was printed in multiple copies on soft white paper acquired from PRN-225 and handed out to the esteemed representatives when they arrived. The second was circulated and then kept in Samantha Carter's pocket and was much more interesting. Day 1. Afternoon. Civilian and Section Heads Assembly Gate Room. Greetings and Goodwill Ceremony. 2 hours of chanting and some ceremonial face paint. Good times. Evening. Formal reception, mess hall, buffet dinner. Uniforms pressed and ironed, people. Day 2. Athosian Sunrise Ceremony Central Tower. Taylor says she can fake something awesome for this, plus tea. Ronan, be sure all the representatives are awake by 05:30. Breakfast with the senior medical staff, mess hall. Informal discussions of rotting diseases, a plus. Morning. Lab tour. McKay, feel free to pretend they're as interested in what you do as you are. Picnic lunch, Pier 14. Afternoon. Senior staff meeting with IOA representatives, budgetary concerns, Q&A session. Pegasus Galaxy field trip. The historic ruins of MT-5900. Local name Enos. Ronan Dex and Jennifer Keller tour guides. Informal dinner, mess hall. Evening. Movie night in the film auditorium. Opening film. Scientific relations in the Pegasus Galaxy. McKay crushes the opposition. Feature. Casablanca. Nobody gets to throw popcorn, I mean it. Late showing for Night Owls. Mystery Science Theater 3000 presents Manos, the Hand of Fate. Day 3. Breakfast with senior military staff, mess hall. Shepard, can you actually hold forth on War and Peace? Morning. Civilian City Hall meeting, mess hall. No issue too small for discussion. Lunch will be served at the close of the city meeting hall. Preferably around, say, 1400. Afternoon free time to explore the city, if schedule allows. 1500. Citywide Assembly, East Pier. Marine drills under the command of Major Evan Lorne. You can make this impressive, Lorne. You don't have to bore them. Athosian ceremonial dancing. With dangerous sticks. Oration on international goodwill by Radek Zelenka. Trust me, this is going to be hilarious. Who knew Zelenka was so ironic? Spinning and sharpshooting demonstration. Canadian Irregular Blaster Corps. Chuck, are you sure you're okay with this? Picnic dinner, East Pier. Evening. Starlight Dance and Musical Concert, East Pier. Fireworks provided by Atlantean Pyrotechnic Squad under the command of Lieutenant Laura Cadman. Day 4. Breakfast with Science Staff, Anthropology and Botany Department. Smelly plants, a plus. Morning. What can Atlantean medical technology do for you? Invasive demonstration of medical scanning and biopsy devices by Dr. Keller. Lunch and exit briefing with Colonel Carter, mess hall. Afternoon, farewell ceremony. More face painting. IOA representatives depart 1400 hours. Ronan found the IOA representatives extremely soothing because they took one look at him and then a second look at the blaster strapped to each leg and didn't ask him for a single thing the entire visit. Only one of them said anything to him at all, other than the necessary pleasantries. She seemed nice, actually, and he felt a little sorry for her. Dr. Kokov was new to the IOA, hadn't been on the board when he'd gone to Earth for his interviews, and he sensed that maybe she represented a change in the political winds. "I am told you are from Setida," she said to him, keeping up relatively easily while the others huffed and puffed around the ruins of Enos. "I understand your homeworld was culled by the Wraith."
"That's right," he said.
"I'm sorry. I hope you know that Earth's presence here in Atlantis means we're doing everything possible to battle this new menace."
"Hardly new," he grunted.
"Well, not to you, I suppose."
"Anyway," he said awkwardly, "I'm immigrating."
She looked at him, confused. "Immigrating? To where? Atlantis?"
"Atlantis isn't a country."
"No, not really, but..."
"Canada," he said, and she actually stopped walking. He kept going. After a few seconds, he heard her running to catch up with him.
"You're immigrating to Canada?"
"Figuratively."
"How do you figuratively immigrate?"
"Gonna get my citizenship. And a new tattoo," he added, pointing to the one on his throat.
"Ah, I see.
Wasn't there something about a Canadian military corps? They're doing some kind of demonstration for us tomorrow night.
The irregulars, Ronan supplied.
Do you know any of them?
One or two, he answered, amused. The next evening, as he and Chuck were checking their equipment during Zelenka's speech, which was every ounce as funny to the Atlanteans as promised, though the IOA didn't seem to be in on the joke, he caught Dr. Kakov's eyes and grinned at her.
You about ready? Chuck asked,
adjusting the strap that held the scrounged cricket bat on his back. Think so. You still okay with this? Ronan replied, passing him a handful of golf balls to shove into his pockets.
Sure. It's not me doing most of the shooting. Hey, Chuck squinted at him. Is that a new shirt?
So? Trying to impress Dr. Kakov? I heard her say she thinks you're hot. Ronan glanced at him. You're fucking with me, aren't you? Chuck grinned. Just a little. But she doesn't have to say it. She checked out your ass. Whatever, Ronan said, crossing his arms.
Game face time? Chuck asked.
Game face time. Zelenka finished wild applause and foot stamping from the assembled population of Atlantis, bowed, and vacated the stage as a pair of burly marines lifted his makeshift lectern and carried it off behind him. Ronan double-checked that his holster straps were secure, and then led the way up to the platform. Next time he heard Chuck take a deep, nervous breath.
The Canadian Irregular Blaster Corps presents a demonstration of armed proficiency for the edification of the Atlantean mission and the entertainment of the IOA, Chuck called out. From somewhere in the back, Lauren blew a shrill wolf whistle. Chuck's voice dropped to near inaudible. 1, 2, 3, 4.
Ronan's right hand flipped his blaster out of his holster almost of its own accord, at the same time as Chuck's did. They'd spent every spare minute rehearsing since the news came in, and they were as close to synchronized as they were ever going to get. They started easy with flips and spins, and then he pulled his left blaster as well when Chuck began tossing. He could see the IOA's representatives leaning forward, and some of the Marines whispering to each other. Most of them were staring at Chuck, who wasn't as ostentatious about his skills as Ronan was. Ronan tossed his left blaster behind his back and over his head, which was Chuck's signal to holster his and pull the cricket bat out of the straps on his back.
"Cricket, come on!" someone hollered. "Target one!" Chuck shouted back, and batted a golf ball from his pocket over the heads of the audience.
Ronan kept spinning with his left hand, lifted his right, fired, and blew it to little flaming pieces when it was just past the danger zone. A couple of Marines in the back still ducked. "Hey!" Shepard's voice. They were his golf balls, technically, but Ronan saw McKay clap his hand over Shepard's mouth out of the corner of his eyes.
"Target 2! Target 3!"
Chuck batted two more in quick succession, and Ronan held both blasters up to fire. Dead hits each time. He holstered the left blaster, got one more hit off with the right, and caught the cricket bat without looking, smacking the golf ball high and fast when it entered his line of sight, listening for the rasp of leather that indicated Chuck had redrawn his own. He'd been iffy about letting Chuck do any firing, because he only hit the ball about half the time. But considering everything so far, he didn't think anyone would care if Chuck missed by a mile. And he didn't. The golf ball exploded, raining ash down into the water, and they reholstered their blasters in perfect sync. The crowd went wild. He bowed, and Chuck bowed, and then they bowed to each other, and trooped off the stage, and totally, no matter what anyone said, did not do a full-on body slam once they were mostly out of view. That evening, most of the representatives were too tired to do more than sit and pick at their plates and listen to the music, exactly as Carter intended. But once the dancing began, Dr. Kakov actually asked him to dance. He taught her a Satine waltz while listening to Shepard curse as he continually stepped on Colonel Carter's shoes, and McKay bragged to Cadman about Canadian superiority with firearms. 3 weeks after the IOA visited Atlantis and returned too exhausted to even write reports, the Daedalus arrived with its regular shipments, plus a package for Ronan that he hadn't been expecting. "It's from Dr. Kakov," Shepard said, wagging his eyebrows in an incredibly disturbing way. "Love letter?" Ronan fell back on that old standby, whatever, and tore the large thin envelope open at one end. McKay leaned over his shoulder shamelessly. "Oh my God," he said gleefully when Ronan pulled the sheaf of papers out. "What is it?" Shepard asked, looking irritated.
"Chuck!"
McKay shouted. Chuck, eating with a couple of other gate techs, looked up.
"What?" he called back. "Ronan's a Canadian." "Yeah, I know."
Shepard grabbed the paper from Ronan's weirdly numb fingers as Chuck came over to see what the big deal was. "Certify and declare that Ronan Dex, whose particulars are endorsed hereon, is a Canadian citizen and that he is entitled to all rights, powers, and privileges, and subject to all obligations, duties, and liabilities to which a natural-born Canadian citizen is entitled or subject," Shepard read. He flicked the certificate to the bottom of the pile.
voter card, absentee ballot, you vote in goo...
Guelph, McKay supplied. Nice little town. It's in Ontario.
I know where Guelph is, Ronan managed.
Medical paperwork, weapons permit, hey, that'll be handy. Passport and...
He shook the passport and a small gold coin tumbled out.
A loony, Chuck said, taking it from Shepard and passing it to Ronan.
So much for a rite of initiation, Shepard observed.
We could still blindfold him and beat him with hockey sticks if he really wants one, McKay offered, ducking with a cry of, Delicate brain! As Ronan cuffed him in the head.
He never did find out who left a red command-colored jacket with the Canadian flag hastily sewn onto the arm outside his door the following morning, but he suspected one of the Canadian nurses who was dating the Atlantis outpost quartermaster. McKay shared his MRE brownies with Ronan for 3 whole weeks,
in the spirit of Canadian solidarity, before the novelty wore off, and Shepard stopped looking annoyed that Ronan hadn't picked the United States instead. Shepard never did stop insisting Ronan did it purely for the gravy fries, though.
In Toronto, on a wall in a reputable, if slightly run-down tattoo parlor, there's a photograph of a grinning dreadlock guy who said he was on chore leave and wanted a tattoo. He got a vivid red maple leaf just above his collarbone, arguing the entire time with the tattoo artist about the upcoming parliamentary elections and what the chances were of the Blue Jays taking the American League pennant that year. Story ends.
My Home and Native Land by Copper Badge, written for the LiveJournal community, I Defeated SGA. Post-story notes. God Save Our Queen and Heaven Bless, the Maple Leaf Forever. By Alexander Muir. I am not a Canadian. Actually, I sort of am, depending on how you look at it. My mom was born and raised in Canada, the daughter of a French-Canadian artist and a British aerospace engineer. You would think that would make us more interesting than we are, really. At any rate, they immigrated to the United States, and she became a naturalized citizen as a teenager. Alexander Muir's The Maple Leaf Forever, while perhaps not quite PC anymore, hung on the wall of my childhood home. While I wouldn't say I've traveled extensively in Canada, I have spent quite a bit of time bunking out with friends there, mainly in Toronto and the surrounding area. Many of my ancestors come from Guelph or nearby Allora. The story didn't start out to be about Canada or immigration. I just wanted to look at Ronan as the survivor of a pretty well-advanced society in a lot of ways, and wondered what he would make of these people who are basically not that much further ahead of him technologically and way behind him in other ways, fumbling around with the Stargate and clearly not aware of what most of the Pegasus Galaxy standards when it comes to gate travel. I also have a soft spot for minor recurring characters, so I thought I'd work Chuck in there as his partner in crime. Then my head exploded. It is canon that while the Stargate translates speech, it doesn't translate text. In at least one episode, Trio, McKay mentions that he's the only one present who can read Janai. This is weird, but whatever. I thought it would be interesting to explore Ronan learning to read English, especially since he'd be expected to write his mission reports in a language at least one other person could read. Also, his blaster is way cool, and if I were Chuck, I would totally swap literacy lessons for blaster twirling. In the end, many of the scenes in this fic are also just there so that I can poke sly fun at John Shepard, because that never gets old. Also, though I love the Group of Seven, and Lauren Harris in particular, his paintings really do look like chocolate cake sometimes. Canadian chocolate cake. Hey look, missing scenes! This scene was originally in the body of the fanfic, but was of course joshed by the 5th season opener, so I'm stashing it here. The explosion at Michael's creepy-ass fuck nursery for Taylor's unborn baby put Shepard in the infirmary unconscious. Actually, wait. This scene did end up in the show, and in the main fic, so never mind. I'm going to skip it. Sorry. Back to what she has written. I have no idea where I was going with this, but the outline is fun. Ronan was interested in anthropology, in an offhanded sort of way, and he had begun composing a mental list of the attributes of his immediate companions. 1. Athosians. A. Quiet. B. Badass. C. Can't use contractions. D. Hot. 2. Earthers. A. United Statesians or whatever. 1. Suicidal. 2. Loyal. Noisy. Immature. B. Canadians. 1. Smart. 2. Tenacious. 3. Sarcastic. 4. Pretty good with guns, despite no natural inclination. C. Radek Zelenka. D. Other. I. Afraid of him. This is going to be an introduction to Ronan meeting Chuck's enormously highly Canadian family while on leave. I discarded it as being a trifle too domestic, but I like McKay's social philosophy. Most of the permanent residents of Atlantis,
Scientists who had been there for years, Marines who stayed on for a second tour or volunteered to finish their hitch on Atlantis, were what McKay called Earth loners. Nearly everyone had some family or friends or family back on Earth, but the Earth loners didn't have many, if they had any at all. Shepard was an Earth loner, and McKay. Cadman was an Earth loner, even if she wouldn't have admitted it to save her soul. McKay expounded on his theory once, and only once, perhaps because Shepard had teased him about going in for the soft sciences. It contained an element of social Darwinism and a lot of bitterness about what must have been a hard childhood. Earth loners, by choice or circumstance, were people who had never fit in, and in many cases, never felt the need to. They were hesitant to trust, difficult to befriend, abrasive or socially awkward, or simply more comfortable with solitude than their colleagues. But in Atlantis, they had to make friends and find a circle, find people to connect with, or they would die, literally die, at the hands of the Wraith, or during some citywide catastrophe, or for a million other reasons in the harsh and unforgiving Pegasus Galaxy. They formed deep, weirdly obsessive bonds with other Atlanteans, or they died, or they were gnawingly lonely and shipped back to Earth, where at least there were things like Burger King and cable television. I couldn't resist writing an initiation ceremony. 2 days after the Daedalus arrived, Ronan was pulled out of sleep by someone knocking on his door. It was nearly midnight, which meant either disaster or McKay, who had no sense of time or timing. When he opened the door, it turned out to be not only McKay, but Chuck and Colonel Carter and what looked like the entire Canadian contingent of Atlantis. Shepard and Taylor were there, too. Ronan looked them up and down. Shepard was holding what looked like a blindfold. "We didn't think we could take you physically, so we thought we'd ask politely," McKay said.
"Rite of passage," Ronan replied, nodding. "Cool."
They blindfolded him and took him through the corridors into a transporter and out to the cool Atlantean evening, Chuck's hand on his left elbow, Shepard's on his right. When the blindfold came off again, they were standing at the far tip of one of the Atlantis piers, Atlantis glowing softly over their shoulders. Colonel Carter cleared her throat and stepped forward. "Repeat after me," she said. "I swear."
"I swear."
"That I will be faithful and bear true allegiance."
"That I will be faithful and bear true allegiance."
"To Her Majesty, Queen Elizabeth II, Queen of Canada."
"To Her Majesty, Queen Elizabeth II, Queen of Canada."
"Her heirs and successors."
"Her heirs and successors."
"And that I will faithfully observe the laws of Canada."
"And that I will faithfully observe the laws of Canada."
"And fulfill my duties as a Canadian citizen."
"And fulfill my duties as a Canadian citizen."
She smiled and stepped back, and McKay stepped up importantly, fixing him with his best glare. Ronan grinned at him and opened his mouth before McKay could talk. "Play is offside if a player on the attacking team enters the attacking zone before the puck itself, whether it is being carried by a teammate or sent into the attacking zone by an attacking player. When an offside violation occurs, the linesman blows the play dead, and a face-off is conducted in the neutral zone closest to where the offside occurred." McKay deflated slightly, but rallied pretty well. He pointed at Ronan sternly and said,
"Don't forget it."
He stood back and waved Chuck forward resignedly.
"What'll it be, Ronan?" Chuck asked.
"Service?"
Ronan shook his head.
"McCrae."
A few of the Canadians blinked and shuffled forward. Shepard tilted his head as if he were trying to place a name. Ronan took a breath. "In Flanders Field, the poppies blow between the crosses, row on row, that mark our place, and in the sky the larks, still bravely singing, fly scarce heard amid the guns below," he said. And then those who were confused looked startled or shocked. "We are the dead. Short days ago we lived, felt dawn, saw sunset glow, loved and were loved. And now we lie in Flanders Field." Colonel Carter inhaled sharply. "Take up our quarrel with the foe. To you from failing hands we throw the torch. Be yours to hold it high. If you break faith with us who die, we shall not sleep, though poppies grow in Flanders Fields." I was tempted to give Ronan his own team. These fragmented scenes are the result.
"What?" Ronan asked, shoveling stew in his mouth.
"Specialist desk. Dex," Shepard said, and bit into an apple. "There comes a time in the life of every young man when Papa Bird has to push him out of the nest." Ronan raised an eyebrow.
"Are you okay?"
"Colonel Carter and I decided it was time to think about training some backup team members," Shepard continued. "Plus, we're down two teams since M5L287, and not enough of the scientists are field trained."
"We getting someone new?" Ronan asked.
"No, I'm promoting you."
"To what?"
"Team leader," Shepard said. And Ronan abruptly stopped eating.
"You gotta get out there sometime. You deserve your own team."
Ronan wasn't sure what to say that wouldn't make him sound like a dork, so he kept quiet and breathed deeply through his nose. If you want to, Shepard backpedaled uncertainly. Ronan carefully leaned back and set down his fork and nodded. Yeah, okay. Taylor told him to recruit at least one person who had manners and make sure everyone who joined could take orders. McKay blew him off at first, but eventually said he should pick someone intelligent and, for God's sake, not a linguist, because they were less than useless. Shepard advised him not to poach from other teams and to make sure when he asked people to join that they understood this was a favor as from God, belonging to Ronan's expedition team. Colonel Carter told him to choose friends, and also people he didn't mind being naked in front of. Ronan could have told her that much already. Lorne thought about it for a while, and then said he should have someone on his team for the others to protect. He could have told Lorne that, too. So, you do science stuff, Ronan said to Chuck, sitting down at his table in the mess. You know, when Colonel Shepard does the dumb jock thing, it's kind of endearing. When you try to pull it off, you look like you're just insecure, Chuck said. Ronan rolled his eyes. Okay, you have a double BA in electrical engineering and botany, and an MA in mechanical engineering, Ronan said. Chuck blinked at him. Tell me what BAs and MAs are. Who told you about my degrees? I asked McKay. Well, they're like specialist training, I guess, Chuck said. I also have a self-taught doctorate in gig technology, and if I knew any more about it than I do, I'd probably be considered a danger to galactic security. Why do you want to know? Want to be on my team, Ronan asked. Chuck choked on the water he was drinking and set the cup down, wiping his mouth. Ronan knew the rumors had gone around about his team and how all the Marines were bucking to get on it, and all the scientists were hoping he wouldn't tap one of them. He also knew, because he had good hearing, that none of the techs or engineers thought they were even in the running. Your off-world team? Chuck asked, when he was finally cleared his throat. Really? You can shoot, Ronan said, and we need a guy who knows gate tech. And McKay has one of those mechanical engineering things, too, so it's got to be useful. M.A., though I think his is one of the PhDs, Chuck corrected. I'm the head of my division. I don't know if Colonel Carter will let me go. So are Zelenka and McKay, and they go off-world, Ronan peered at him. Look, if you don't want to. No, I do. Totally, I do. Dibs. Called it shotgun. I do, Chuck blurted. Ronan deliberately intimidated Dr. Brighton into joining the team, because Brighton was small and couldn't shoot and was terrified of Ronan, and in addition to being the one they could protect, it was obvious that it would be terrifically character-building for him. Dex's team came back from their first mission, supposedly a dry run to a planet with a bustling market and no crazy cultist wearing bandages. Seriously, I thought you didn't need supervision, Shepard said, standing in the doorway of the locker room.
I tried to talk them out of it, Brighton said, pulling his shirt off.
There was a white bandage on his shoulder blade. Ronan scratched the tape on his collarbone and grinned.
What did you do? McKay demanded, sitting on a bench and studying the data Chuck had brought him.
Team thing, Ronan replied. Chuck tugged at the bandage on his own collarbone and tilted his head back. Cool, Shepard said, looking interested.
Blood poisoning, McKay exclaimed.
I cleared it, Brighton replied. We probably won't die. We? Ronan said it's regimental, Dears informed then, brushing past Shepard and tossing her vest on the rack. Brighton held his pants up quickly. Oh, relax. You're a doctor. You're not allowed to be modest.
Regimental, McKay said skeptically, craning his head forward to study the small black tattoo on Chuck's collarbone. Right.
All right, so I hope you guys have enjoyed My Home in Native Land by Copper Badge. It's always been one of my favorite Stargate Atlantis stories because, hey, it's about Ronan. And it's even got his one true pairing in there with his blaster, Ronan Blaster, made to be. I think Sam's got some of the most interesting storylines and fun characterizations out there, and I was really hoping that I could share it with you guys, and I wanted to listen to it myself anyway, so I hope you enjoyed it. This is Julie I. Wolf signing off.